Welcome to the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, News Director at KGNU. My co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And we have another local author, Colorado author, here in studio with us. And this has been a great read of Fathers and Fire by author Stephen Wingate. Tell us a little bit about it first.
Well, Stephen, I met Stephen many years ago when he had his short story collection, Wife Shopping. We did some interviews together. And so I was eagerly anticipating a novel. So, you know, here we are 11 years later. Way to go, Steve. So A Father in Fire is a very interesting book. It takes place in the Eastern Plains in 1980, the summer of 1980, which is the Iran hostage crisis. The Reagan-Carter election is in full swing. And it's about a boy who's never known his father. He's been raised by a single mother, and he's in this tiny kind of dying town in Colorado. And then his father comes to town, who, unbeknownst to him, he doesn't realize that's who's come to town. And that's really sets off the action of the story.
But we are delighted to have Stephen Wingate join us live in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, this was quite a read. I mean, Arsene laid it out there, but there were so many layers to the book and so much that's revealed to us as a reader, but also to the various different characters involved, because there's secrecy and, you know, paternity, identity, different things like that. But as you said, Arsene, it's set with the backdrop of the Iran hostage crisis. Reagan is a rising political star, and everybody, it seems, not quite everybody, but most people, certainly in this small town in eastern Colorado, east of Colorado Springs, is all about Reagan. Why did you want to set it in that period, and why have that particular period and political event as the backdrop?
This was the period of my coming of age. I was, 16 when Reagan was elected, a little bit younger than my protagonist, and I was living at the southeastern edge of Colorado Springs. So there's definitely an autobiographical element to it. Ever since then, I've been constantly wrestling with what that phase meant in America, because it was exceptionally weird to just sort of see us going to the spasm of hatred for Iran, and oddly enough, here we are again. I've always felt the need to write about that time because it seemed to me extremely formative of modern America. We found an enemy, we weaponized Christianity, we decided that we were going to make America great, which was a Reagan campaign slogan, and we had the same kind of retro backward-looking vision for America's future that we have today. So I've always been interested in writing about that, and I've spent a lot of years writing about it. And finally, after the election of 2016, I said, I need to really bring this novel home and get it out to the world.
So, you know, the protagonist, Tommy, who's 17 during this summer, before the book opens, you know, we're told that he was kind of all in. He was a great football player. He wanted to join the Marines. But something's happened to him in the 6 months before the opening of the book, before the catalyst of his father coming to town, where he doesn't want to join the Marines. He quits the football team. He doesn't want to die for Reagan's war. He doesn't like Reagan, and that sets him at odds with the whole town, basically.
Yeah, that was the impetus for him to go bad. And he wanted to be a Marine. You know, that was his thing, a Marine and a linebacker. But then he realized, Wait a minute. Why am I going to Iran? I mean, he was afraid, as I was afraid back then, that the draft was going to come back and I was going to get sent to Iran. I mean, if that was my fear back then, and I'm not alone. I mean, you talk to people who were born in 64-ish. A lot of them remember those days. The draft had just ended in, 72, 73. And here we were gearing up for war because the hostages were in Iran. And so there was a lot of generalized anxiety about going back to war, and he didn't really want that. So yes, that's exactly the impetus for him turning against what he had been.
Well, he is full of anxiety, I suppose, but he's also full of rage, and a lot of that rage, it's not just about the possibility of getting drafted in to get sent to Iran to fight Reagan's war, as he calls it. A lot of it is around the identity of his father. And it seems that just even 2 or 3 years prior, I think when he was 14, his mother finally told him who his father was. He'd grown up in a single mom family. Mm-hmm. And she tells him the story that his father is a saxophone player, that he's gone to New York. So this seems to lead him to also become a saxophone player, and he really brings his rage and his inner angst out into his music.
Yeah, he's very enraged about the whole fatherlessness situation. And again, it's a little bit of autobiography. I lost my dad when I was 10. I did know who he was, but I lost him. And I know that feeling of not really having a father. For Tommy, it's extremely more severe. And he has invented this entire identity that is ultimately false, because his father's not a saxophone player. But he's invested in becoming this person, this imaginary person for himself, simply because he needs an escape. He needs an identity. There's no obvious identity for him that's related to the father. Where do I come from? So he's a messed up kid, as I think a lot of kids in Bildungsroman are. Those coming of age novels, they're joyful because they deal with messed up people, and there are a lot of layers to Tommy's mess, which is tremendous fun to write.
I couldn't tell whether he was a really good saxophone player or not a very good saxophone player, because you write about how he plays with such passion, but I couldn't get a sense as to the musicality of it.
I could play you some, and it would sound like Tommy. Tommy's not a very good saxophone player, to be perfectly honest. He is unschooled. He is self-taught. His saxophone, although it's a very high-quality saxophone, is kind of broken because it was in a car accident, and he found it in a junkyard. So he doesn't really know what he's doing, but what he does know, what he does feel, is the intense spiritual nature of music. And in that sense, he is a very true and pure musician. But if you put him up next to someone who actually played the saxophone, he would sound pretty terrible.
Right. He can play by ear. You hum something to him, he can play it back to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to have you read a little bit. And this is pretty much from pretty soon in the opening of the book, a few pages in. And I don't think we need to say too much to set it up beyond what we've talked about. But if you want to say something more, go ahead.
No, but I think it's very nicely set up with the saxophone conversation and all, because this is Tommy leaving the house where he lives with his mother to go to his private place and play a little saxophone. Tommy walked up Mangum Street past the McCassick's house. Jim and Marcine, sitting on their blue plaid couch watching a rerun of Alice, had been waiting to die the longest. He had to remember to take their trash to the dump. That's the other thing Suborney was famous for, being on the way to the dump. Half the people who set foot in town came for Hegren's junk, and the other half for Sowell's gas after they dumped their trash. "Good night, Tom," called Julie Parnes from the next house. She was a little young for Suborney, only 50, but made up for it by being the kind of drunk who slept until afternoon. She swung silently on her front porch swing, its chains sprayed with WD-40 every Sunday so they wouldn't creak against the eye bolts. Tommy only waved back at Julie, wanting to save his breath for the scale that rolled through his body. The low D in the sax was hard to hit, since that key wouldn't close all the way, and for some reason the high C gave him trouble too. But he didn't mind, because the bad keys gave him notes that bent and songs that sounded like nobody else's, that didn't even sound like bebop, to be honest. He'd felt those notes bending themselves into a scale in his bedroom after supper, while he clenched his teeth and listened to Sheriff Bullshit lecture his mom about the Ayatollah. Jimmy Carter wasn't doing to stop him because he was the biggest pussy America ever put in the White House. But Reagan, who for sure was no pussy, could make this country stand up for itself again. "If we have to march into Iran and kill the bad people so the good ones can be free," he said, "then so be it. Because freedom's the most important thing. And if Americans don't stand up for it all over the world, what good are we?" "Uh-huh," his mom said back, nodding along to the idea of a war that her own son might die in. Tommy had almost bitten his tongue in half listening to Stannard's bullshit. And now he was desperate to get his lips around that mouthpiece and say a few things back.
That's author Stephen Wingate reading from his novel Of Fathers and Fire. It is set in this small town east of Colorado Springs. You mentioned there the dump. I mean, Tommy talks about this. It's one of the things that the town is known for. And that is a theme that runs throughout the book, because they're constantly picking up trash that blows into the town from the dump. And it's a Sisyphean task, because it never, ever ends. And yet they keep doing it. Why did you want to have the dump as a real focal point of the town?
Because it's just shows how nowhere and nothing the town is, and how isolated life can be when you're in the middle of nowhere and there's really nothing around you. And that is something that shaped my teenage psyche. I'm originally a kid from North Jersey. I grew up 7 miles outside of New York City. But then when I was 13, I moved to Colorado Springs. And suddenly I was faced with this immense emptiness of a type I'd never known before. So I was walking the plains and walking the plains, and this is where kind of Tommy's psyche and mine match, that nowhere town where there's really nothing going on, where people are leaving from, it's a wonderful place for me to write fiction in or about, because that loneliness and isolation and feeling of purposelessness is a wonderful catalyst for change. You know that if you're in that kind of place, you're either on your way out of the world or you got to do something.
So Tommy plays the sax in a broken down church. Mm. And that is what draws this kind of religious troupe, the sons and daughters of Jesus and Mary, and a particular man, Richard Thorpe, who's going to play a major role in the book. And the role of religion is very interesting. Tommy has had a fixation on Jesus since he's a very young boy, and his mother doesn't want anything to do with it. And so he's attracted to the sons and daughters of Jesus and Mary. And I thought it was very interesting that you have the teenage son being the righteous one, and the mother is the one who's having to defend herself against like a righteous son, kid, you know, which I've seen like a reversal of a lot of yes. relationships.
Yeah, for sure. There's the religion in this book is meant to be complex. There's I don't think anyone who's looking for a simple answer in this book about religion is going to get one. I think it in some ways plays an incredibly positive role in Tommy's life, and in others is incredibly destructive to him and to the people around. The sons and daughters of Jesus and Mary are kind of a little bit like the Catholic workers. They're a little bit like the whole Dorothy Day phenomenon. It's kind of a mendicant group. They just go from one place to another. They work, they help people. They are paid in food, and they just kind of live to work another day. And I find something really, really beautiful about that. I think also in this book, they're not entirely working from the best premises. I think they're a little bit misguided in how they actually function in the book. They make some mistakes.
Well, I thought it was interesting, you know, as they come into town, you think, oh, this is going to be some crazy evangelizing cult. And they're not. For the most part, they're, you know, they're doing good work. They're harmless, basically. If you don't want to interact with them, you don't interact with them. But there is a layer that's going on here where Richard, who we find out very early in the book, is Tommy's father. And he is kind of, that's why they're there. And mm-hmm. so there's something dishonest about why they're yeah. actually in this town.
Yeah, they got pulled into it. And they followed him. And Richie Thorpe, I think, is a man with good intentions who doesn't know how to express himself. I don't find him evil. I didn't try to draw him evil. But he definitely makes some emotional mistakes as he tries to get his son back. He spent 16 years in prison, and he wants to see his son again. But he doesn't really handle that very well.
Well, he wants to see his son for the first time. Because yeah. here's yeah, what I thought exactly. was interesting is the mother moves away. Mm. I don't want to give away the whole book, but the mother moves away and has changed her name and has never had any contact whatsoever. She's done everything she can to just disappear and form a new life. So it is kind of quite scary that he shows up, isn't it?
Very, yeah.
And that he tracks it up. But in the book, the person with the most rage, I think, ends up being the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think, is that because she has the most to lose? Is that when you were drawing that character? Because that rage never seems to really die down.
She's been stuck in a very tough situation. And she's actually stuck herself into a very tough situation by deciding to live a lie. And I think the fact that she has persisted in her lie to Tommy about who his father was, even when the real father is in town, has taken her rage and really crystallized it and made it more and more solid and firm. So I would agree with you. She's the one person that doesn't really have the outlet for the rage. I mean, Tommy has his rage, but he finds his father. Richie has his rage, but he finds his son. And even though their rage is not transmuted in any way, at least it kind of goes somewhere. At least there's some kind of finding and resolution. But with Connie, there's really nothing but that rage itself persisting.
I had a lot of sympathy for Connie, and especially as the book progresses and, you know, the layers start to peel back as to why this group is in town and Richard Thorpe and his connection to Tommy and stuff, because she's very much painted as like the Scarlet Woman throughout the book by the town, by this radio DJ who hosts a religious radio show, who happens to be the brother of this man that she's having an affair with. Yeah. But I think it seems certainly from the book, she's done her best, given the circumstances, you know, to really raise Tommy. And then this group comes in, and you mentioned it earlier, and I thought it was a really good phrase, the weaponization of religion and the weaponization of Christianity. And I feel a lot of that was targeted at her as a so-called fallen woman, that all the guilt lies on the mother for creating the situation. And of course, you know, that's not the case at all.
I think most of the anger that Thorpe is feeling toward her is for lying and escaping and pulling away and finding that new name and that new life. And then the sons and daughters really kind of follow along with that. I think Tommy is the one who ultimately paints her as the fallen woman more than anyone, which is another kind of reversal of what you would normally expect. The kid who's, you know, growing up as a teenager in the 80s, you might expect to have you know, a more liberal attitude towards sexuality, but he doesn't. It's one of those very ways that he's kind of mixed up. He's got a lot of layers to him. He's got many conflicting personalities within himself, which makes him really, really fun to write.
It was interesting because the period that this is in, of course, as we mentioned, it's, you know, the backdrop of the Iran hostage crisis, the looming election of Reagan. But obviously there was no social media or anything going on there. But a kind of a version of that was this radio show that I mentioned that Tommy would call in once a week when this guy gets on the radio. He's based out of Colorado Springs, and sort of give news or share news and almost communicate with his mother through the radio station. I mean, I thought that was a really interesting way to have, this is how we're going to spread the word about various different things that were happening.
Thanks. Colorado Springs radio at that time was really strange. Listening to AM radio, in Colorado Springs and listen to the what we called then the fundamentalist community was a mind trip, because people said all sorts of insane things that I just could not square with the Christianity that I grew up with. One of the things, big conflicts I see underneath this book is this collision between two different visions of what Christianity is, and one of which is, you know, I call punishment Christianity, and the other is mercy Christianity. So in some ways, the sons and daughters with their kind of spirit of generosity toward others, even though they're misled, they represent kind of what we used to call the Jesus freaks, which were kind of dying out. There was just still a tiny bit little of the Jesus freak movement left around 1980, and it collides with the rising of the evangelical movement, which is much more about, you know, you have to do this and this and this and this. And so when Connie responds to Christianity, she's responding to punishment Christianity, and she doesn't see in her son's vision of what Christianity can be any kind of mercy. She's cut off from that. I think everybody in this novel is cut off from their own emotional life in a way that is painful, but again, really interesting to write. Those are the best kind of characters.
Yeah, Connie really keeps waiting for the punishment that they're going to punish. And that's why she, to me, it seems like she maintains the lie. She's like, well, they're going to punish me as soon as the truth is out. And so let them be the ones who put out the truth rather than me, so then they can come punish me. And so I thought that I felt a ton of sympathy for Connie too. And in some ways I wanted something better for her, you know, like, and I think that, you know, because some of the book is set up on a lie, but the lie is something that she created when she was 16 and she created it with her mother's help. So I it's hard to hold the 16-year-old so responsible, I think, when you really, these are young characters, right? So Tommy's 17, his mother's only like 33, 34, and Richard Thorpe's only in his 36, 37 maybe. These are pretty young people.
Yeah, and they're all playing a game of chicken, and everybody loses in their own way.
Uh-huh. Do you feel, when you're writing Was there a temptation to have anybody win, or did you know that this can't work out for anybody, or had you played with the narrative in some ways?
The early drafts, I was trying to make some kind of a point. I think a lot of writers do that early on, and then you go back to it and you realize, well, maybe there's not a point here, but maybe there's an interesting character or set of characters that I can work with and explore. I don't feel like at this moment there's any point to the novel. It's just not. I mean, if I could make a point, it would do it much more simply and not spend a decade working on it.
Stephen Wingate is our guest today at the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, my co-host as always, Arsen Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And we're talking about Stephen's latest book, Of Fathers and Fire. Now, fire plays a big role in this. We're not going to give too much away because there's great plot, there's incredible characters, but also wonderful plot development. There's a lot going on in the book as well. But fire and water, in an almost biblical sense, and the character's relationship to it is a big aspect of this. And it's not magical realism, but then it's getting into sort of weird religious powers and various different things. So kind of talk us through why you wanted to have fire and water and people's power over fire and water and those elements as part of this.
I think it's even pre-biblical. I think that if you look at the history of world religions, you'll see that many of them are animist, and that even the religions that we have today grow out of or have embraced parts of animist religions, the really ancient religions. You go back to the beginnings of humanity and civilization, like when we first started to bury the dead, to me is when, it's a really clear start for when religion starts. And this is an immense part of human history. And for most of human history, we've had a strong connection in our spiritual lives to the elements. And that lives on in this day, in all sorts of different kinds of religions and rituals that happen. So I've been fascinated by that all my life. I would love to go back to the very beginnings of human history and just find out what people were doing and thinking. So that kind of element, I agree, it's not really magical realism. It's not something I look at as a style. I'm kind of exploring an aspect of humanity and saying, all right, how does this play out in the modern world?
Some of your characters some powers beyond supernatural, almost, or beyond a natural setting, which I thought was interesting. One thing I wanted to talk about is hate. We talked about rage and hate, and this is again getting to this almost supernatural element of the book. There's a physical element to hate. Maybe you could describe that a little bit. Like, how does it manifest itself physically?
Well, I think there are probably an immense amount of doctors, holistic doctors in Boulder, who could probably explain it a lot better than I could. But I do believe that our emotions live inside of our body, including really old emotions in our own lives. And there's even some recent studies saying that there's multi-generational aspect to trauma. And again, it's trying to go back into a sort of a pre-modern way of looking at humans. If you go back to the deepest and earliest religions, you go back to the shamanic religions, there's the things that are spiritual and ailing you are things that are kind of in your body, and they can be dealt with by things that are in your body. And I still think that we have that today. I just don't think that we use very much of it. I can feel in my body, certain things happen in my life, at work or at home. I'm like, oh, yep, that part of my body is seizing up. And that's just one small taste of what I think that we actually are capable of understanding about our own bodies and our own spirits as they work together.
So in the book, you kind of brought that to another level, though, right? I mean, where they can physically get the hate out of themselves.
Yeah, that was fun. I loved writing that scene.
And then there's a consciousness about it, because then they destroy it. They watch it burn, getting back to the fire thing. But it made me so jealous, because I was like, I would love to be able to physically reach in and take out stuff and remove it in a very conscious way. I always remember my mother used to say, I keep all my anger in my hips. Mm. And I used to think she was nuts, because, I mean, I was a kid, I didn't know. But now I completely understand that that's where you keep your stress and you keep your emotions that manifests itself in different ways physically for different people.
Mm. I think we're capable of so much more. You know, like they say, computers, you only use 10% of the computer. We're only using 10%, maybe less, of the self. We're capable of achieving so much more understanding and wholeness. And who knows, maybe we are capable of doing things that are beyond what we think of as the normal and ordinary. And I wanted to explore that.
What I thought was interesting, though, was even though they're able to remove some hate and burn it, it doesn't end the hate. It's like it keeps going. You know, like I thought maybe, you know, hey, if Tommy can get some of this hate out, then he will have a different attitude towards his mother, right? But he doesn't. He tries, but, you know, so it's like a never-ending resource, unfortunately, right?
Totally. Totally. I mean, I'm sure there are ways that we can make ourselves right so that we don't generate that hate in our lives. I believe it. Otherwise, life would not be worth living. But I don't think any of the characters in the book find the way to do that. And I'm not sure that that many people on Earth really find a way to do that either. But I'm always listening for people's ideas on how they manage to get away from that, because it is a very human cycle.
You have one character that has no hate. You have like a character that's pure innocence, and that's Tessie. And I was wondering if you could tell us about her and what role she plays in all this going on with the father, the son, the mother. You know, she's a little bit to the side, but a critical role.
Yeah, nobody's ever asked me about Tessie before, and it's really hard to talk about it. It's a character who just makes me cry, I think, because of that innocence. Tessie is an eight or so year old child who was found by one of the sons and daughters, had been left to die, a deformed child. And Sapansky, the tall guy in the book, he sees this girl and feels like, wow, I've just been called. I've just been called by God. Do I let this child die, or do I take care of this child? And so he just picks up the child and becomes the child's father. And to me, it's incredibly selfless. And she is the glue of that community, of the sons and daughters. They all kind of work to keep her alive. And she doesn't have any of that hate, as you said. And she also has the gift of music. She is the person that Tommy first communicates with, because she doesn't really speak, but she can sing. She can make these song-like sounds. And Tommy answers her back with his saxophone. I hadn't really ever talked about her before, so thanks for asking.
There were such a group of interesting characters, both in the group of Christians, the hippie Jesus freaks, as they call them, you know, who come to town, but also the folks who live in the town as well. And I think you write them all in a way that veers very far away from stereotypes. I think it's very easy to dip into stereotypes of, you know, small town life. And you really, I think, give a nuanced way of looking at all the different characters. I mean, there's no black and white figure that you can just put each one of them into a box.
Thank you. I owe it all to just a catchphrase from one of my teachers in grad school, Stuart Kaminsky, who said he was a mystery writer, Chicago-based guy, died 5 or 6 years ago. And he said, always give your characters their best shot. You know, each of your characters is a whole person. They are the protagonist of their own drama. They believe that they're right, even if they've had to twist their own minds into that. So I've really tried to follow that dictum and just make sure that I'm not painting the characters with too broad of a brush. That's the other thing that comes with working on a book over time. I would love to be a faster author, but I'm not sure it would make my work any better.
Of Fathers and Fire, the latest book by Stephen Wingate, who has been our guest here at the Radio Book Club. We do encourage you to subscribe to the podcast, because you can catch some after hours content that's only available on the podcast. So we're going to have Stephen stick around for after hours at the Radio Book Club. I want to talk more about religious radio in Colorado Springs, because that's still a thing. But Arson, as we always do at the end of each episode, we announce the next book that we're inviting listeners to read along with us.
It's going to be The Gifted School by Bruce Holsinger. The Gifted School is set in Crystal, Colorado, which seems a lot like Boulder. There's a walking mall called the Emerald Mall, as opposed to Pearl Street. And it's about a magnet school being formed and a group of parents that desperately want to get their children into this school for gifted children, and how it tears apart friendships and lifelong relationships.
Well, we're going to be talking about that on the 4th Thursday of September at 9 o'clock. That's the 4th Thursday of every month. You can catch the Radio Book Club. And as I said, don't forget, you can subscribe to a podcast. Stephen Wingate has been our guest this month. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you both. This has been wonderful.
I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. As always, my co-host. Thanks, Arsene.
Thank you, Maeve.